And joining us on Perspectives today is Dr. Ellis Dragert. Dr. Dragert is a professor of clinical medical humanities and bioethics at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. She is the author of several books, and her latest book is Galileo's Middle Finger: Heretics, Activists, and the Search for Justice in Science. Alice, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, let's talk a little bit about your background. And first of all, how did you get involved in science and going to school, pursuing that PhD? And just have you always been interested in science?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been interested in science, although I have to confess to you, it's not in the book. I was a college dropout because I was really tired of, when I was at university for the first year, just having professors tell me what to think, tell me what to read. And I really thought college was going to be different. I thought I was going to get to learn what I wanted to learn, to expand my mind outwards. And it just seemed like a lot of dogma, so I actually dropped out of college and became a mortgage broker.
Wow.
For 5 years. But at the end of it, I was finishing up my degree at the local state university in New York, and my advisor told me about graduate school and about how I could go and really research what I wanted to understand, and that seemed so cool. So I went to Indiana University and did a degree in history of science, and that means you basically study the history of what's happened in science. And that may sound really boring, but it's actually super interesting because science is not a closed box. It's really fascinating. So I got into doing that, and the work I did for my graduate work was on the history of the people who in the 19th century were called hermaphrodites. Today they're usually called intersex people. These are people who have some sort of sex anatomy that's different from the usual male type or the usual female type. They have something in between. And so I got into studying that, what had happened to those people in the 1800s, and what happened was people who were born with those conditions today started to write to me and ask me to change the medical system with them. And I was surprised by that, in part because I guess I thought of these people as people of the past, but they're people of the present. And so I got into trying to help reform the medical system because it was problematic. And that brought me into sort of a life of activism as well as doing scholarship. So I ended up kind of living two lives, and that's what this book is about having sympathy kind of for both sides, for people who are scholars but also people who are activists.
Now, when you mentioned people in the 1800s, a lot of people will think, well, gosh, you know, that's a long time ago. And we're, you know, currently celebrating the 150th anniversary of the end of the Civil War and President Lincoln's assassination. But you think back about, you know, how were people treated in the 1800s and what did they look like? What did they look for information? You know, we have the internet, we have Facebook, everything else. So out of curiosity, just what did you find out about these people in the 1800s and what they had to deal with?
Yeah, you know, you're right. Today, people can look things up for themselves. But of course, back then, if a man seemed to be menstruating, which happened sometimes, he had no way to find out what was going on except to go to a doctor. Or if a woman had never menstruated, she had no way to figure that out except to go to the doctor. And so these folks would go to the doctors, and the doctors would start doing examinations on them. Not very invasive ones, because it was too dangerous at that time to do any kind of invasive examination. So they would look over their bodies and try to do physical exams and try to figure out what was going on based on what the person told them. And over again, doctors were finding people who had sex types that were not clearly male or female but were something in between. And that really surprised the physicians. So they would find sometimes, for example, that a woman was very clearly a woman on the outside but had testes on the inside, or that a man was very clearly masculine on the outside but had ovaries on the inside.
Now,
and in some cases that they had blends of both in the inside.
We're visiting with Dr. Alice Dragert. Dr. Dragert is the author of the book Galileo's Middle Finger. And as you just heard a little while ago, she's been talking about her research, her doctoral thesis, her doctoral dissertation, and of course this book. And when you're talking about the doctors who saw these people, because medicine was still kind of, you know, coming of age back then. In fact, the Civil War introduced a lot of medical terms and things to them because of how to treat them out in the field, embalming. What did doctors, Victorian age doctors, decide to do, or did they put these people on display like P.T. Barnum and, you know, other things like that?
Yeah, no, they didn't put them on display except sometimes in teaching hospitals when they were teaching other doctors. And in that case, they were sort of a private display for the physicians, which was problematic but not as bad as what you're describing.
Okay.
But basically, what they decided to do was to come up with a system, scientific system, where they could claim everybody was really either male or female. And so what they decided was that unless you had both ovarian and testicular tissue inside of you, you weren't really a, what they called hermaphrodite. You were in a pseudo-hermaphrodite, a fake one. And so they were able to label almost everybody as truly male or truly female, and that allowed them to keep the social system that they believed was natural. So these doctors had a system that was very strictly sex-segregated. You know, women couldn't vote, women couldn't get higher education, women couldn't own property. So in a system like that, to have people who were in between was really socially challenging. So what they did was come up with a scientific system to try to claim that everybody was sortable. But that was a problem because sometimes you had these women who had testes inside, and what were you going to say, that they were really men? Or you had men who had ovaries inside, were you going to say they were really women? So they did a lot of covering up, frankly. They did a lot of talking among themselves, among the doctors, but often didn't tell the patients what was going on and certainly didn't tell anybody else what was going on.
Now, was this worldwide or just here in the United States?
The place I actually studied was France and Britain, but the same sort of thing happened in the United States. And you're right, it happened in part because medicine was coming of age. So doctors were, for the first time, examining people who weren't wealthy. Usually, people wouldn't have seen a doctor if they weren't very, very sick or if they weren't wealthy. And so this is a relatively new concept. So because gynecology was coming to be for the first time, and also because there were a lot of wars going on internationally, a lot of men were being conscripted into the armies around the world. And the consequence of that was they were for the first time being subject to doctors who were doing genital exams. So that's why so many cases started to show up all of a sudden. They've always existed. But it was really new to have cases showing up time and time and time again, and then to have people going to doctors and finding out that they weren't what they thought they were.
Now, in the age of, you know, like when we had the Salem witch trials, and then you might have a, a Native American tribe or some kind of other Native tribe in Africa or in Europe, parts of Europe that are not in with a civilization, when something like this came up, did they think something like superstitious, witchcraft, or they were being punished by God?
It depends on the culture. Some cultures saw these folks as having special powers, so there's some Native American groups, we think, although it's difficult to know because their history was destroyed with their populations, but we think some Native American groups had a special category for these folks and recognized them as having sort of special supernatural status. In some places in the world, yes, they were denigrated, although very rarely were they seen as sort of the work of the devil. Usually, you know, what happens is a child is born into a family, and the family loves them no matter what happens with the child. That's true throughout history and throughout time. So in most circumstances, people just found ways to adapt. And most of the time, the way they adapted was to just force somebody into a either male or female role and just assume that that was the right thing to do.
We are visiting with Alice Drager. Dr. Drager is the author of the recent book, Galileo's Middle Finger. One of the things that comes to mind is, and of course you're familiar with it because you do research and all that, this is the fact that we're starting to see a lot of transgender issues coming up. And I think the world was kind of like, oh my gosh, what's going on with, you know, Michael Jackson and then now Bruce Jenner. And people are saying, well, what's this and what's this all about? And of course, people see this man who was always seen as a, you know, great athlete, Olympic, and who is now changing. They're thinking something is wrong here, but they're quick to brand, quick to judge, and not very many of them try and find out what's going on.
Yeah, so what we've been talking about is intersex, and that's where your body has some difference in terms of the male and the female development, so you're somewhere in between in the male and the female development. And transgender is a little bit different. It's about how you feel. So I usually explain to people that intersex is about your body and transgender is about your mind. So how you feel in terms of your gender identity cannot, sometimes doesn't match your body. And so that's what we're talking about when we're talking about transgender. So there's no reason to believe that most people with transgender have any form of intersex. We don't find any form of intersex in them. And most people who are intersex actually keep whatever gender they were given at birth. So they usually keep the gender of boy or girl depending on which one they were given at birth. So they're not the same thing, although in some people they overlap. And why is it coming around so much? Well, it's partly because it's available as a cultural category. So when cultures make available additional categories, people recognize themselves into those categories and inhabit them and take those categories on. That doesn't mean that people didn't feel transgender in the past. In the same way, that doesn't mean there wasn't intersex people in the past. There was. But as we create the categories, then we start to identify the people who are in those categories.
Now, as a researcher, Dr. Drager, Alice, the fact that you know, when parents, their child is born, they check, does he have, you know, 10 fingers? Does he have 10 toes? Oh, he seems okay. And then they're happy. They watch the child grow. At what point does this child start exhibiting these changes of intersex? And if they do when they're young, how do the parents handle it, or how have they handled it in the past, and how is that changing?
Sex development is super duper complicated, which I didn't know when I went to graduate school. I thought everybody was either male or female, and it came as news to me that a lot of people are actually in between. So sex, intersex can show up at birth in the form of having a child whose genitals don't fit the standard male or the standard female type. So they may have something in between, something kind of in between a clitoris and a penis, and something in between a scrotum and labia. But a lot of forms of intersex, actually, the person on the outside looks very typically male or female, but inside they have the organs of the other sex, or they have mixed organs inside. So it can show up actually throughout the lifespan. Sometimes people find it on amniocentesis, when they're doing that on a pregnancy. Sometimes it shows up at birth. Sometimes at puberty, when you expect the person to go through a particular kind of puberty, and they don't, they go through a different kind of puberty. Sometimes it shows up when people are trying to have a baby and they can't get pregnant, so they end up at a fertility clinic, and either the husband or the wife will be discovered to have some form of intersex. And sometimes people live a long life. I've read cases where people die in their 90s never suspecting anything, and somebody happens to do an autopsy and discover intersex. So it can be all over the map. In terms of the way parents react, that's, again, very individual. And how the parents react depends a lot on how the doctors react. And I'm part of the medical reform movement that's trying to make things better. So one of the things we train people to do is to not freak out in the delivery room if a child is born and the sex isn't clear, but rather to emphasize to the parents the health of the child and that this is a known condition and that we're going to figure out what's going on and we'll help you understand if you've had a boy or a girl. So some parents deal with it extremely well. Other parents have a lot of grief, a lot of shame. They undergo a lot of guilt reactions. And all of it really indicates to us that this is a stressful thing, because in our society we still have mostly two categories, and people are expected to fit one or the other. And when a baby is born and it doesn't seem to be clear which one you're supposed to put the baby in, that's really confusing and stressful.
Now, what about when you mentioned earlier, if a man is showing signs of menstruating, that could, you know, raise a flag for the patient and for the family or doctor. But what about, we hear a lot now about men going through andropause.
Yeah, andropause is controversial in the medical literature. What we know is that as we age, the amount of testosterone and estrogen that we're producing, and men and women actually produce both of those hormones in their bodies. We all produce the same hormones. We just produce them in different quantities. The amounts of hormones we are producing changes. So we usually think about sex development as finishing at puberty, that we go through puberty and that's when our sex development ends, but that's actually not the case. Our sex continues to develop throughout our lifespan, and one of the ways it continues to develop is that our hormones change as we get into older life. And we could see that actually as a normal part of sex development. Instead, we act like, you know, your middle years are somehow the years you're supposed to maintain. But we know that there's probably reasons why our hormones sort of slack off as time goes on and change in terms of quantities. It doesn't have to be thought of as something terrible.
We're visiting with Dr. Alice Drager. Alice Drager is the author of the recent book, Galileo's Middle Finger. Tell us about the title, Alice.
Sure. So this book actually traces the work I started doing in my dissertation 20 years ago, and it comes all the way forward to the work that I did that got me sort of caught between scientists and activists. And what the title refers to is Galileo himself. So Galileo was a scientist who lived about 400 years ago, and he was one of the people who supported Copernicus's idea that the sun is actually in the center and we go around the sun, not the other way around. And when Galileo died, he was out of favor with the church. The church was furious with him because he was challenging church doctrine by supporting Copernicus. So he was buried in a really plain grave. And about 100 years after he died, they realized he was actually right, and he was now considered a sort of scientific saint. And so they were moving his body to a very grand tomb in the Basilica of Santa Croce in Florence. And as they were doing that, one of his devotees, a guy who was a big fan of his, decided to cut off a few of his fingers to keep as sort of saint's relics. And so one of the fingers that got cut off was his middle finger. It ended up getting mounted on a marble pedestal under glass and being put on display in a museum. And I came upon it in graduate school, and it completely cracked me up. In Italy, the middle finger raised skyward doesn't mean what it means in the United States. It's a different gesture there. But it completely cracked me up because it seemed to symbolize Galileo sort of telling the universe, I won in the end. And so I was thinking about that as I worked on this book, and the book is really about scientists who challenge people's ideas about human identity, who don't take the popular, politically correct view of things, but challenge people on questions of what it means to be male or female, or whether or not rape is natural, whether or not we can recover memories of sexual childhood abuse. A lot of these stories I tell revolve around issues of sex, because sex is very, very controversial in our culture. So I thought that the middle finger made a logical sort of motif for the book, because it centers around the idea of the scientist sort of flipping the bird to the rest of the world, saying, I'm right, and in the end you're going to understand that I'm right, and the world kind of fighting back.
And you've gotten a lot of interesting reviews. In fact, Jared Diamond, who wrote Guns, Germs, and Steel in the World Until Yesterday, gave you some very good reviews. And one of the things that he writes about here is when it says that you began to realize how some of the fellow progressive activists were employing lies and personal attacks, if you will, to silence scientists whose data revealed uncomfortable truths about humans in researching these cases.
Yeah, and I found that very disturbing, because I'm a political progressive, but I also don't believe that you should make things up. And that's what I was finding as I started doing this work. I was finding scientists who were accused of being sort of right-wing, accused of being anti-woman, anti-whatever. And when you actually dug into it, you realize, no, that in fact all they had done was make a challenging claim, a claim that made us uncomfortable, but they hadn't called anybody any names. They hadn't concluded that somebody was inferior to somebody else, nothing of the kind. And so time and again, I was finding these scientists who were actually themselves politically progressive people being set upon by mobs of activists who started making false claims about them and their work, and in some cases nearly ruined their lives, ruined their reputations, forced them to have to hire expensive lawyers, threatened their jobs in many cases. It was really quite shocking, and it really disturbed me, because I have a long history of doing activism, but to see this kind of activism was to me very, very disturbing, and that's part of the reason I did use the motif of Galileo, because it really felt like these folks were functioning kind of like the Catholic Church at that time, which was to be a sort of, have an attitude, we know what's right, we know what's wrong, and we're going to tell you no matter what evidence you have. And for me, it has to really come down to the question of, well, what evidence do we have? And even if the evidence makes us uncomfortable, we have to face it.
Now, one of the things that it's interesting, when you open up the book in the intro, and you talk a little bit about, you write about that you're going to get into the death threats, the sex changes, the alleged genocides, epidemics, et cetera. But you talk about, you know, what you grew up with, I guess, and you're aware of the stereotype that many liberals have about conservative Catholics. And so with the way those beliefs are and the beliefs they had in the Victorian age and what things are today, did you have a hard time as far as, like, because as you mentioned, you're helping both sides, you're kind of in the middle, but did you have a hard time kind of settling in and saying, look, people, I want to help, but I want to help both sides, and I think I can do this by, you know, my research and my writing, and just, I think people want to know why you were getting death threats and everything else. Well, not you personally, but...
Yes, I'm happy to say I have not personally received death threats except once, which I think was a joke. I can't tell, but I think it was a joke. But it didn't alarm me very much. But a lot of the scientists that I study have. You know, the reason I wanted to deal with it really was because my feeling is, if we're going to move forward as a democracy, then we have to have a system where we know what's true and then we figure out what to do with it. And the scientists are the people who help us figure out what is true. And then the activists help us think about, well, what do we do with that? But if what's going on is the activists are telling the scientists what's true without doing any work, and the scientists try to tell the activists the way the world should work without really engaging in a conversation, then it all collapses. So stepping in between was difficult, and I must say that when you step between two warring factions, what happens is you get hit with ammunition from both sides. And that's kind of what happened to me over and over again, and I chart that through the book. But I remain sympathetic, very much so, to both groups. my parents are conservative Catholic, but they're also they raised us as activists. They were right to life activists, and they very much believe in the idea that, you know, democracy is yours to make it what you think it should be. And so they were very much of the mind that we should engage ourselves politically and try to help the oppressed, try to help people who were genuinely oppressed. And so I really kept that with me, even as I did not remain a Catholic. And I remain also sympathetic to the scholars, because my parents also were very interested in scholarship, as am I. And the question of, well, how do we know what's true? And how are we going to go out and find out what we need to know in order to make the world a better place? So I think both sides are really, really important. And if what they're doing is kind of taking pot shots at each other or making death threats or trying to shut each other down, then you have a huge problem. And most of the time, it's not the scientists going after the activists. The scientists just ignore the activists, and the activists attack the scientists.
We are visiting with Dr. Alice Drager. Alice is the author of the book, Galileo's Middle Finger. And one of the things, going back to your parents, because as you mentioned, you know, they were brought up and they were exposed to different things like the Second World War and the different rights issues. And your mother, as you said, was, very much in favor of women's rights and getting involved in all that. Now, you also write in your book about the fact that because science has really, become a sword in this issue, and that is that of spiritualism, and where some people say, well, I can't believe in a higher being because I'm a scientist, or I don't believe science because I believe in God, or, I believe in God, but I also believe in science, and then there are some people who are caught in the middle. When you write about having to talk to your parents about you being an atheist, was that a difficult thing to do, and how did the parents, your parents treat you?
What I would say is it's still a difficult thing to do because my parents are still alive and they still struggle with that, which I understand. You know, from their point of view, our lives are eternal, and so they're worried that I'm ruining my eternal life by being an atheist. And I understand that as a manifestation of their love, so I totally understand the pain I'm causing them, and I'm sorry, actually, for that pain. But it is a difficult conversation because where they come from is from a place of faith and belief, and that just doesn't exist for me. Where I come from is from a place of really wanting to look at data, accept uncertainty where uncertainty exists, just saying that that's a limitation of our ability to know, not that we're not supposed to know. So it is still in some ways a struggle. And it's funny, my sister is a conservative Catholic nun and also a physician, and I'm an atheist sex researcher. So when you see the two of us together, it always kind of cracks me up. But to my mind, it's a logical manifestation of our parents, which was to say that they raised us both to be activists, both to be scholars, and one of us had faith and one of us didn't. And so we make, to my mind, a logical pair. But when my students run into my sister giving an ethics lecture and they say, I met a nun whose last name is the same as you, and she looks it like you. What are the odds? Yes, what are the odds? They say, no, what are the odds? And I'm like, she's my sister. Don't be silly. They just don't believe it because they know me to be a sort of potty-mouthed, you know, sailing swearer, sex researcher, somebody who's out there sort of in a lot of intense controversies, and so they don't picture us coming from the same family. But to my mind, it makes complete sense.
What about the people? We've talked a little bit about the scientists and the doctors. What about the patients, the common people, the ones who are faced with these issues? And, you know, to them, it can become a bigger problem because they're afraid of being accepted. They're afraid of telling someone. What if someone finds out? So they're kind of living in a world of fear. But at the same time, here comes along somebody like you who has a key, opens up that door, and you can come out or stay in, whatever you want to do, but you're going to have to face some kind of criticism regardless, as you mentioned, from the left or the right, because you're in the middle.
Yeah, you know, the controversy stuff does open me up to a lot of battles in between, but in addition to that, and I don't talk about this much in the book because it doesn't belong in this book, I've actually worked individually with a lot of people who are coming to terms with their own medical histories that have been kept secret from them, or are coming to terms with discovering feelings in themselves, in the case of transgender, that have gone unrecognized until then in terms of other people not realizing it, and helping them understand how to think about themselves, how to find other people. That's been a great privilege in my life, and it's been a source of great joy. One of the things that I do is pro bono, so I don't charge people. I help people recover their medical records, and I write a short history for them of what happened to them personally. And it's private. I don't publish it. I give it to them to do whatever they want to have done with it. You know, I do it with their permission and their cooperation. But it's a really powerful thing because I think a lot of people in our culture just, they know parts of their history, but they are missing important parts as well. And that's especially true when people go through medical trauma. Our medical systems now are so invasive. They're very different from the Victorian system. They're tremendously invasive. And the consequence is, even when doctors are trying to help, in many cases, people are left with enormous amounts of trauma to their bodies and to their psychological health. And so trying to help people sort of piece it back together to understand what happened to them in a hospital, to understand why what happened happened, and try to put it together, that's been a really important part of my life's work and a really meaningful part of it.
And mentioning, going back to your family, what about the families of the individuals? Because it also depends, I guess, in the culture they were brought in, because in some cultures, you know, certain things are very taboo, whether you're a conservative Roman Catholic, conservative Christian, or, you know, just have this idea that it's taboo and you don't talk about it. And all of a sudden, you know, you're shame and you're kind of not talked about or put aside. And this has got to be a difficult relationship for the child and the parent.
I think you're right. It can be difficult, but I would emphasize that it's in my experience that many conservative Christian families have absolutely no trouble accepting intersex children, the reason being that they have the belief God doesn't make mistakes. And so they understand these children to have bodies that are different, but that doesn't mean they're not lovable, not perfectly acceptable, that they can't be fully loved the way they are. So I've met a number of Christian families who have not elected to do invasive surgeries that are medically unnecessary to try to make their children look more typical in terms of male or female, because their attitude is God sent this child into the world for a reason. So people's political beliefs don't always map to how they react to their children, and it's been very interesting for me to see how varied it is. You know, you might think that progressive liberal parents would say, oh, an intersex child can be raised as a boy or girl with no surgery, and we should just accept them the way they are. But some of those people are very quick and say, no, normality is key to psychological health, and you have to go get these very invasive, very risky surgeries. And then I've met, like I said, some very conservative families who are very accepting of children, no matter how they come, and who often manage the medical system, I think, with a lot more skepticism that's really healthy and useful. So it varies kind of all over the map.
We are visiting with Dr. Alice Drager. Alice is the author of the book Galileo's Middle Finger, Heretics, Activists, and the Search for Justice in Science. We're running out of time, so probably this may be the last question. And this is something that I think needs to be brought out, because some people may be confused or not be aware of. And I'm not saying that, you and I or everybody else are, super scholarly, but what is the difference between intersex and transgender?
So what I usually tell people is that intersex and transgender people have different different situations, but that they both face difficult medical systems, and that's why we end up hearing about them in the same breath. So intersex is when your body type doesn't fit the usual male or the usual female type. So that may mean that you have genitals that are in between. It might mean that inside the organs are not what you would expect. It may mean your chromosomes in terms of your XX and your XY are different than you would expect. Whereas transgender means that the way you feel about yourself doesn't match the gender you were given at birth. So at birth, all of us are given a gender assignment as boys or girls, and that's done based on the best guess. Our parents look at us and they say, that looks like a girl or that looks like a boy, and they assign that gender. For some people, when they grow, they don't feel that that's the right gender. They feel that they were assigned one that doesn't make sense for them, and they end up undertaking the opposite gender assignment because it feels more correct to them. So that's really the difference, is I would say intersex is about your body pretty much from your neck down, and transgender is about your brain in the sense that it's about how you feel.
We're visiting with Dr. Alice Drager. Alice is the author of the book Galileo's Middle Finger, Heretics, Activists, and the Search for Justice in Science. Alice, excuse me, you were mentioning earlier that you work with, kind of in the middle of both groups, scientists and people who, are activists or have, been aware or have some kind of contact with intersex. Is there a specific website or websites that people can go to find out more about your research, about what you found, and perhaps it gives more information for people on intersex?
My website gives sort of pointers of where to look and information that I've provided, and that's alicedreger.com. But a really great website for looking up information about intersex conditions is accordalliance.org, so accordalliance.org. And that's a group that's working to change the medical system and make it much better in terms of being honest with families, in terms of providing psychosocial help, providing genetic counseling, providing really a full range of services to those families and connecting them with other families. So that's an excellent organization that I work with. And I'm very proud of the work that they're doing nationally to really change the medical system to make it much more supportive of these families.
And when they go into either your website or an intersex website that's going to help them, talking about your book again a little bit, Galileo's Middle Finger, some people might be a little weary because you're a professor, you've done a lot of research, so they think, this book is not going to be easy to read, but it's very readable. The narrative, just from the beginning, you start as you're telling the story.
Yeah, I write for popular audiences, so I don't write in a stiff style. I try to write in a way that everybody can understand. And my editors were great on this book, very much about, can we make this sentence a little clearer? Can we make this concept? Can you give an analogy here to help people understand? Because these are some pretty intense concepts that are unfamiliar to most people. So I've heard from a lot of readers who said they really understood it by the end, and they really appreciated sort of understanding the variations that we have in our lives and the kinds of ways they play out politically, that it was of interest to them.
And there are, of course, other books that preceded yours that came out. I think one came out in 2000. I think it was something like The Boy Who Was Raised as a Girl or something like that.
Yes, by John Colapinto.
Yes.
Yes, As Nature Made Him is the main title of that book. And that's an excellent book that explores what happened to a boy who was born actually a typical male, but who had his penis damaged by a doctor by accident, and he ended up being sex changed into a girl and ultimately identifying as a man and finding out what happened to him. He wasn't born intersex, but what happened to him was the typical intersex experience of shame, of secrecy, of sex change, of all sorts of very invasive procedures done not out of medical necessity, but out of the belief that you have to make kids look sex typical, which usually means turning them into girls. And so that's a very, very wonderful, powerful book by John Colapinto.
I'm glad you mentioned kids because sometimes, young adults, teenagers, are faced with so many obstacles, peer pressure, a lot of stuff at school, and then now something like this. So is this a big issue among teens, and is there a help out there for them who may want to consider, who may be suicidal or anything like this?
Yes, and again, Accord Alliance is a good place to look to find information about the support groups, but the support groups are excellent now, and there's teen support divisions within the support groups now, which did not exist when I started this work 20 years ago. There was no discussion with the teenagers about what was really going on with them. People thought they couldn't handle it, they couldn't take their medical information and understand it, and now we know they're so much better off if you tell them the truth, engage them with the medical decision-making, really be honest with teenagers, because teenagers are coming into adulthood, and they're capable of understanding a huge amount. So the teen support groups are wonderful. And so, for example, in one of the support groups has a teen support group for girls who have found out that they have testes inside. That's a tough thing to find out. You look like a typical female. You feel like a typical female. You look to everybody like a female, absolutely. You've been raised that way. There were no suspicions. Then you don't menstruate, and it turns out that's because you actually have testes inside that are not, that your body system's not working the normal way. The body's not responding to the testosterone, but you have testes inside. How do you tell, yourself that? How do you tell your friends that? How do you tell your boyfriend or your girlfriend that? How do you manage that? And so these are support groups that really help these kids and help them understand what's sex going to be like, what's marriage going to be like, can you adopt, are you going to be able to have a child biologically? In that case, no. But are there, how do you deal with adoption systems? And it's really wonderful because it totally takes away the veil of shame that's existed for these folks for thousands and thousands of years, and instead provides a system that says, you can have sexual privacy, but you also are entitled to know what happened to you and to let people you want to have know what happened to you. That is just life-changing for these folks, and it absolutely helps with mental health issues. There's no question about it.
Well, Alice, we want to thank you very much for taking the time to be with us here today. We've been visiting with Dr. Alice Dreger, that is Dreger, and her book is Galileo's Middle Finger, Heretics, Activists, and the Search for Justice in Science.
Thanks again, Louis. This was great.
Thank you. Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Belinda Fernandez. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.